Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio in real time via ZipWhip landline texting at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
It is our General Assembly preview, the last of our parts of our General Assembly preview, talking with local legislators. House Speaker Bill Howell of Stafford joins us this morning. Mr. Speaker, it's good to have you here. Good morning.
Thank you, Ted. It's great to be here. Good morning to you.
Getting ready, I guess, to go down to Richmond again for another. This is another a long session because you deal with the budget this year.
That's exactly right. We write the two-year budget, or we work on the two-year budget, and it's a 60-day session, so we should get out the second week in March, something like that.
Last year, you got out a day early, didn't you?
We sure did. That was good. That hadn't happened in about 15 years. We finished the budget ahead of time and got all our business done, and we're able to leave a day early. I'd love to be able to do that again this year.
Other times it gets stretched out, so we'll see what goes on. I know one of the things talking about the governor has already released or talked about his budget, and now you all start to work on it. And I know one of the concerns, and your colleagues who have come in here before you have expressed the concern that a lot of the money and a lot of the promises the governor has made has been based on Medicaid expansion money being in that budget, and that does not appear Medicaid expansion to be happening.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting budget, as you know, Ted. In our Constitution, the governor introduces the budget. He draws the 2-year budget up, and then it goes to the legislature and the House. Takes a look at it, and the Senate takes a look at it, and they'll both make some changes to it, and then they get together and hopefully can come up with one bill. Goes back to the governor. He gets one more whack at it. He can amend and veto certain items, and then hopefully we'll all be done on time. The governor's budget is very very ambitious. He does include the expansion of Medicaid within his budget, and somehow he determines that that's going to generate $300 million in new money and savings. It's interesting that every other state that has expanded Medicaid is finding that the additional costs, the unexpected, unanticipated costs, are running into literally billions of dollars in some states. And so that part of the equation we think is somewhat suspect. He takes $150 million roughly of that $300 million savings, which the expansion is going to generate, and uses that for the cost of the expansion. Now, this is the first time that the administration's acknowledged that there's a cost to expanding Medicaid, and he recognizes that it's going to cost at least $150 million to get it started. But he puts the other $150 million into a variety of things. I think they were mostly put in there to entice Republican votes. There are things like tax cuts. He hasn't been thought of as a person that's interested in cutting taxes, but he has a very small cut in the corporate income tax, and as well as a couple of very small cuts in the individual income tax. All totals about $100 million. And the problem that he's got, and then he's taken some of that other money and he's put it in things like giving money to the Massey Cancer Center for research and different programs like that, which are very attractive, and they're ones that we support. However, he's got a contingent on passing of the expansion of Medicaid. Golly day, in this budget that we're looking at over the next 2 years, we are looking at having to increase our spending by nearly $1 billion over the 2 years, about $900 and some million for existing Medicaid, for the additional unanticipated costs in existing Medicaid. If we were to add 300,000 or 400,000 people to that role of Medicaid, as I've said before, you know, right now in Virginia, we have a population of about 8.4 million people, and there's about nearly a million of them are on Medicaid, existing Medicaid now. Expansion would probably drop up to another 400,000 people onto those roles. One of the biggest concerns that people don't really focus on is the fact that the people that are on Medicaid today often find trouble in finding physicians that will treat them for a variety of reasons. And if you were to increase those roles by about 40%, I don't think there would be enough physicians and hospitals and people to take care of them. And so Medicaid today is truly a safety net for the people that, that genuinely need it. And we're going to push them aside so that we can cover 400,000 more people who in many cases are able-bodied, young, single men or whatever that don't have the needs that, that existing Medicaid patients yeah. do. So it's a concern. It's a problem. It's not going to – I don't think we're going to – the legislature is going to pass it. And so when we look at the budget, we'll have to find ways to come up with other ideas.
Well, and you have – and you just mentioned a few minutes ago just about how the other states who've signed on to Medicaid expansion have found some of these costs. That's what you had talked about from the get-go, that,
yeah.
that was the concern.
Yeah, it's a very real concern. And in Ohio, they're looking at over about $2 billion in additional Medicaid expenses. And that's money they have to come up with. It's not free money, as they call it, coming from the federal government, which, of course, isn't free. It's borrowed money. Kentucky's looking at nearly $1 billion in unanticipated expenses. You can go around from state to state that's done it. They're having problems with it.
One of the things I guess you'd really have to keep your eye on, too, is just – you have in recent years, but the growing federal deficit and what's happening in Washington. And now you keep hearing you keep hearing economists and people concerned about another recession.
Oh, I think that's a very real concern. And you're exactly right, Ted. We need to budget, I think, in a very conservative fashion because – the economy in Virginia has been particularly hard hit by sequestration, by government cutbacks. We've lost over $9 billion in federal spending over the last several years just through sequestration and cutbacks. And as a result, the economic growth in Virginia in 2014 the economic growth in Virginia in 2014 was the 48th best, the second from the third worst in the country. We grew at almost 0%. And ordinarily, Virginia's come out of recessions with a very strong recovery. It's not uncommon in past recessions to see Virginia emerge at a 4 or 5, even a 6% growth rate. And now we're at a 0.02% growth rate. And I'm afraid, as you've mentioned, that that there's some real signs that we may well be looking at another recession in 2016. You know, they come about every 8 years, and the last one was in 2008.
Yeah.
And that's not written in stone, obviously, but there are some leading economic indicators, commodity prices, manufacturing reports, that would indicate that the economy is slowing down. So we need to plan for that as well.
Well, and I guess what makes that – scary and tough is it doesn't feel like we've ever really come out of a recovery from 08.
No, we haven't. You're exactly right. And that, again, in previous recessions, because of the government proximity to Virginia, because of the military, we've done very well coming out of recessions. Remember, we always used to say, well, Virginia's pretty much recession-proof because we've got the
yeah.
government pumping money into the state. Well, they're not doing it anymore. And that's that's not all bad. The as you said earlier, the federal debt now is about $19 trillion, and we just can't continue at that rate. I've mentioned before the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan research group of Congress, has indicated as that it forecasted that in the year 2020, which now is only 4 years away, 5 years away, amount of revenue that they anticipate being generated by the federal government, the amount of income that they're going to get from taxes and other fees, 84% of that is going to be eaten up by Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest on the debt, leaving 16% of revenue to fund the government, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just unsustainable. So we have to do a lot of contemplation on how we're going to deal with that.
Yeah, that'll all be tied in and talked about during the upcoming session when you talk about the budget.
Mm-hmm.
House Speaker Bill Howell of Stafford here this morning. When we come back, you mentioned or you talked earlier this week about or made some changes and talked about more openness in the whole budgeting process and some things going on in Richmond. We'll talk about that when we come back with Speaker Bill Howell on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
House Speaker Bill Howell of Stafford with us this morning as we preview the General Assembly session Wednesday. It all starts in Richmond. Wednesday, I get the House will formally reelect you as Speaker of the House.
I've got my fingers crossed. Yeah, that's the plan.
Noon the session goes into effect, then it starts, and then Wednesday night the governor gives his State of the Commonwealth.
Yes, yeah. So it's we'll be off and running on the 13th.
With a longer session, even though you're dealing with the budget, a lot of bills. It's fast moving, though.
It is. It's very fast moving. But we do a lot in 60 days. I've been down at the Capitol last week or so, taking the bills that have already been introduced and assigning them to the different committees. And I guess I'm up at about 360 now, but we'll probably have about, at least 1,000 bills that'll be introduced. And fortunately, they won't all become law. But
And a lot of them, though, do make the House floor, and a lot of, at times, really passionate debate goes on over a lot of this.
Yeah, things will pick up.
You made a couple of changes this week of how things run in the House for more transparency.
Right. We've really been working on this for the past 15 years in Virginia on transparency and fairness and accountability. We started when we took over control of the House, we passed several pretty significant rule changes where we had proportional membership on all committees. It used to be when I first went in the House that that you had maybe 25% Republican participation and 75% Democrat participation on committees, when the actual numbers might be closer to 40-60. So we have proportional representation on committees. I think everybody gets an opportunity to put in their bills. We do limit bills in the short session, which I think has helped somewhat, the number of bills that you can introduce. But in the long session that we're at now, everybody can put in as many as they want. What we did the other day was a couple of things. One, we changed the House rules to provide that we've had a sort of an unwritten policy over the last forever that if there were a sort of an emergency situation that came up on a piece of legislation, you could meet at the chairman's desk on the floor of the House of Delegates. Well, this precluded the public from having any input. There was no really nefarious plans, schemes to try and get stuff done without people knowing about it. It was just trying to hurry things along. Mm-hmm. But we've decided that we have the time to involve the public in that. So we're going to now there'll be no more meetings at the desk. We'll do them in a public meeting room downstairs. So we've made a couple of transparency decisions, changes like that. And I think in the long run, I think it's all very helpful. The other thing we did, we put into the House rules or joint rules that the budget will come from the conference report, that you're going to see the budget conference report and have at least 48 hours to look at it before we have to take a vote on it. Sometimes in the past, and this again, it's not been done for any purpose to try and pull something over on somebody, but just the crush of time. We've gotten the budget and had maybe 4 or 5 hours to look at it before we had to vote on it. Now we're going to give everybody 48 hours, and I think that's significant.
Yeah, I haven't heard complaints about Richmond, but that's in Washington. You're always hearing about things like that. But you're right. You may end up having at times when there is a crunch, having to be in Richmond an extra day or two.
Yes.
But that way everybody gets a chance to look at it,
and that's important,
and make a say on it.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've talked about this before, just some of the changes over the years in Richmond, the fact that both the floor sessions in the House and Senate, you can sit and watch from your computer. I don't know how many people do that. I do it, but I've always wondered how many other people do. I find it really fascinating to watch government work like that.
Yeah. It has been, I think, opening up the process some, and we welcome that. I think it's a good thing. It probably keeps some of my members on their better behavior, which I appreciate, because they know that they're being watched around the world. I was out of town one time when they had a special session, and was able to watch it on my computer from London, England.
Yeah, I remember that a few years ago when it was the veto session. Yeah. I think you missed, and that I never thought that you could watch it from there. Delegate Orrock, when he was in, we were talking about there's just the fact that, because he says you've got to be careful when you're sitting on the House floor if you go to ESPN or something on your computer, because people in the balcony see that kind of thing. And so he'd said that just things like that you have to be more careful of.
You have to watch, be careful. You know, everybody has their little laptops now. And I suspect people sometimes when the debate gets a little long might check the news on their computer, play bingo or whatever they play on it. And they have to remember that the press sits right behind that last row there, and they're looking over your shoulders, and I wouldn't want to be caught with playing blackjack on my computer during debate.
Yeah, during a floor session, you're right. You as speaker try to keep things moving, and I guess that's one of the things that you try to do to just keep be fair to everybody, to both sides, but also to keep the process moving.
Yeah. You know, again, it used to be that people would stand up if they wanted to be recognized by the speaker, and and sometimes you'd have four or five, six people standing up at the same time, and the speaker would kind of look around and call on one. What we've done is we have at your desk, you have a little box where you can vote yes or no, and you can also vote that you want to speak, and so it lights up on my console, and I can look and see who wants to speak, and I try and do it in the number that they're on there. I look at who's first, second, or third, and I try and call on everybody, and we try and minimize the debate. Sometimes legislators have a habit of repeating what's been said three or four times before, and we try and curb that best we can. But everybody has been elected by the same number of people. Everybody down there has been elected by people back home that want them to serve their interests and want them to have their say. And we have to be cognizant of that. We have to remember that what they say is just as important as what I think or anybody else says.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that you take seriously as speaker is to be fair to both sides, both the Republicans, you're Republican, but also the Democrats. And I remember a few years ago when there was an issue of whether a bill was germane, that you really struggled with that and ended up, as I remember, siding against some people in your own party on a particular bill. But and I remember when you gave your explanation to the Senate, just talked about the integrity of what's done down there.
Yeah, that's very important, I think. And I think we all have to be aware of that, of the history, the integrity, the reputation, on and on. It's very important to, I think, to all of us, or most of us, certainly.
There's a court case now involving this, but there's redistricting is something we keep hearing about, and we always hear about nonpartisan redistricting.
Right?
Is that possible to do nonpartisan redistricting? It sounds great, but often wondered. At some point, everybody's got a feeling on something.
Yeah, I have some real concerns about it. You know, the Constitution of Virginia gives the right to do the redistricting, the reapportionment every 10 years to the General Assembly. And it's a bill that then has to be approved by the governor. And, of course, up until very recently, Virginia's plans then had to be approved by the Justice Department to make sure that they were racially balanced. And to take that process away from the elected delegates and give it to an unelected group of citizens, people, who allegedly we'd be bipartisan, I think would be inappropriate. And there are checks and balances. We have a Democratic governor who can certainly veto or amend parts of bills that he doesn't like. We have the federal government looking over our shoulder. There are two federal and one state lawsuit going on right now about redistricting. So people have recourse in the courts. And I think the present system works pretty well.
Yeah, you do wonder how any other system.
Right.
It's hard to imagine that there can be a truly nonpartisan or fair way to do it.
Right. You know, because of the Civil Rights Act, we particularly have to make sure that we are fair to all racial identities. And in order to accomplish this, sometimes the districts aren't a perfect rectangle or a perfect square. They look kind of funny, but that's mm-hmm. because you have to go pick up certain areas of population. And again, I think it's all part of the U.S. Supreme Court had that famous one man, one vote decision a while ago that everybody has to be equally represented. And that's the main thing that we look at in redistricting.
It's been interesting over the years just how your district has changed.
Yeah, it's changed, but it's gotten smaller geographically.
Yeah.
Even though it's doubled in size from the population standpoint, just because of the one man, one vote. They take the population every 10 years and divide it by 100, and that's how many people are in a House district. The Senate, of course, they has only 40 members, so they divide it by 40, I guess. Their districts are about 2.5 times bigger than ours. But this area has been so has seen such rapid growth that my district – I used to have part of Fauquier County and all of the city of Fredericksburg and all of the county of Stafford, and now I have – part of the – not even half of the city of the county of Stafford and about a third of the city of Fredericksburg.
Yeah. What, Delegate Cole has – he's got the – does he have the other half of the city?
Yes.
Yeah, sort of thought. Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's – I remember when you had Fauquier and mm-hmm. it's changed quite a bit. House Speaker Bill Howell of Stafford here this morning. We'll talk transportation and gun laws when we come back on Town Talk this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 830.
Okay, listen. We got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
House Speaker Bill Howell of Stafford here this morning as we preview the General Assembly session that starts on Wednesday in Richmond. This is a budget year, so legislators in Richmond for 60 days or so. I know... Mr. Speaker, a couple of things. The governor and the attorney general have, in dealing with guns, we've seen guns on a national level, but they've also made some changes with gun laws in Virginia. I know that have some legislators concerned. I know that was the governor did he banned guns from state buildings,
right.
And then there was last week or so the attorney general. And the carry law,
right.
That we won't recognize some states, and
yeah.
I've heard that some legislators are crafting legislation.
Yeah, I'm sure that there'll be a response, particularly to Attorney General Herring's position that the concealed weapon reciprocity statutes that agreements we have with other states is no longer valid. That's really pretty significant for people that travel and have a concealed weapon permit and carry their weapons with them. Both the governor's actions and the attorney general's actions are kind of similar to what's happening in Washington, where the president, if he's unable to get something through Congress, he says he'll do it by executive order or executive action, I think they call it now. And I think both the governor and the attorney general are taking that same approach. The governor has said that it's that you're not able to even if you have a concealed weapon permit to carry a weapon in any government building, state government building. The exception is the legislature, the Capitol, because he doesn't control that. We do. But I have members that have a concealed weapon permit, and they say, now can we? Does this mean we can't have when we drive into the state library parking lot and leave our car there? What are we supposed to do with our concealed weapon? There's a lot of questions that have been raised by that. We've been trying to get some answers from the administration and from the Capitol Police, and it's somewhat problematic. But I think we'll be able to work through it. The reciprocity issue that the Attorney General has declared is much more problematic because, again, a lot of people – what the original concealed weapon reciprocity bill said that the Attorney General, in consultation with the Superintendent of State Police, could determine whether or not they should continue reciprocity with a particular state. The point being that, you know, if Nebraska gave concealed weapon permits to anybody that walked in off the street, you know, perhaps we wouldn't want to recognize those people in Virginia, so maybe we shouldn't have a reciprocal agreement with them. But it does say that you need to look at it. And we don't think that the Attorney General really took a hard look at them. We just think he summarily what he's done is he's ended reciprocity with 25 of the 30 states that we have had agreements with. And, you know, if you're a business person and you carry a concealed weapon for what could maybe you carry a lot of cash with you, whatever reason, now if you under this edict of the Attorney General, if you're legally carrying your weapon in Virginia and you're driving to North Carolina or Tennessee and get pulled over for a traffic violation and have this weapon, you could be in very serious felony problems. And so it's something we are looking at right now to see if we can either address legislatively or – I mean, I think you can make a good argument that he didn't consult with the state police and that he didn't follow the terms of the code. I think you could also make a pretty good argument that's a decision that needs to be made by the legislature, not by the executive branch. And so we'll see what comes with those things. But it's problematic. The people with concealed weapon permits – I don't have a concealed weapon permit. Don't own a gun. But I'm a strong believer in the Second Amendment. And I'm also – I hate to see these freedoms. You know, continually our freedoms are being encroached upon or being reduced by both the federal and the state government. And that's concerning.
You mentioned just a few minutes ago about the executive actions and whether they in Washington or in Richmond. I just don't remember in the past seeing, especially in Richmond, a governor doing executive actions kind of things. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like we're seeing that a lot more.
Yeah, I think we are. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, all governors have done them in Virginia. Typically, they'll do one or two on election day, fulfilling some sort of promise or commitment
right.
they made during the election. But you don't see much of them. They're really more for emergency type of situations, I would think.
The transportation, one local transportation issue that we hear a lot about is concern about the hot lanes ending in North Stafford and,
right.
and wanting to move them back. Is there anything that will the General Assembly get involved with that?
I don't think they will. I saw where. I think Mark Coles put a bill in that's going to direct VDOT to take the express lanes down to Route 17 in Stafford. I don't think we can do that legislatively. There's a procurement process we need to go through and whatever. The VDOT has met with Transurban, the people that are managing the express lanes, and as you know, they're going to extend them about 2.5 miles from where they're stopping now. That'll get them beyond Route 610, and about 30% of the traffic gets off it on 610. So that ought to help somewhat. You're going to have a problem where five lanes or two lanes go into one, and that one lane goes into three more lanes. But I think overall, they've been a tremendous success. The opportunity now to go to Northern Virginia and know that you can get there in an hour and 10 minutes wherever you're going or whatever, as long as it's not a rush hour, serious time, I think is really helpful. And it's going to get better. It's going to get better. One of the biggest problems we have, and it's kind of frustrating, Ted, is that the continual cry that you get, particularly from some of the local advocacy groups about we need more money for transportation, we need more money. Well, we just raised $1 billion a year in additional money a couple of years ago. The Fredericksburg region is getting probably 30-40% more money over the next 6 years than they got over the previous 6 years. Let's see how things go. One of the biggest problems we have, and I mentioned this earlier at a Chamber of Commerce meeting, as long as the counties keep approving 2,000 homes in here and 1,500 homes there, every one of those homes is going to have one or two or three cars. Every one of those cars is going to dump out on 95 at some point. You're going to have these problems, and we need to be, I think, cognizant of that side of it as well.
I have thought of you often as I have sat through Planning Commission meetings and boards of supervisors. and even city council, as they've approved some of these, and I've thought of that, that a lot of them are always the first to say the state needs to do more, and this is awful, and it's going to get worse, and yet Spotsylvania and Stafford have approved some really big developments.
Yeah, and I'm not anti big projects. I'm not anti growth at all. I'm very much a free market type of guy. But perhaps there's got to be some more give and take in the process on what you do about the transportation. What can you do to make sure that isn't a problem?
One of the things, and you've experienced this firsthand, when certain projects, when they get finished and work, are a sight to behold. The Falmouth intersection now.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
It's just, you look at it and you just think, boy, you wish 20 years ago this could have been fixed.
I was telling somebody that exact thing yesterday. Why didn't we do this 15 or 20 years ago? And to be fair to VDOT, they tried. They would come up with a lot of plans, and for one reason or another, the county board wouldn't accept it, or somebody didn't like it. And this was sort of their last effort, and it's been marvelous the way it's worked.
Now you go through there at any time of day now, and I've found myself running late to go to some place and think I'm going to get caught at the Falmouth light, and you're there for a minute, and you just think when it does work, when it does work, and when it's too long. You talked about this a few years ago when the debate on the bill was going through with the money. It's unfortunate that these projects take so long, but in some ways you can't get around. You run into federal regulations and state regulations.
Yeah, all the environmental impact statements and things that one has to do really do lengthen the time.
As far as this session, you hear there's always talk about education. Any changes you see with coming down the pike for education funding or anything like that?
Yeah, for education funding, one of the things we do periodically, about every couple of years, is what we call re-benchmarking, where we take a look at the amount of money we're giving to the various localities for school, for K through 12, and we adjust that upward. And we've got probably nearly $500 million in the next biennial budget set aside for this re-benchmarking. So there will be new money coming. We also are continuing to look at the structure of K-12 education. As you know, Ted, and we've talked about this, there's been some real hard looking at these standards of learning, and we've decreased the number of tests that the kids have to take. I think we're going to continue to look at that. One thing that's going to be interesting, there's to pass a constitutional amendment, a resolution has to be passed by two separate legislative terms with an intervening election. So we first passed this bill on giving more leeway to charter schools in Virginia, allowing the State Board of Education to be involved in the decision-making rather than just local school boards. That resolution passed last year. There was an election, and so we're going to vote on that again this year. If it passes again this year, then it will go to the people to be voted on this fall in the elections. And I think that would be a significant opportunity if we could have right now Virginia's only got about a half dozen charter schools in the state. And the reason is that the authority for charter schools is given by the Constitution to the local governments. And local governments are a little concerned with the local school boards about charter schools because they see them as threats, as taking money away from their money. And I can understand that concern, but I think it's not well-founded, and I think this might be a good opportunity. So we always do a lot with K-12 and higher education.
House Speaker Bill Hollis Stafford here this morning. We will wrap this up when we come back on Town Talk this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
House Speaker Bill Howell of Stafford here this morning. We were previewing the upcoming General Assembly session. We were talking about education. I guess, one of the things that you hear locally, school resource officers, because they're in high schools and in middle schools in most localities, and other legislators who've been in here have talked about how they'd like to see them in all schools. But again, it's a cost kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a money factor. There's no question about it. But they're a wonderful tool. I think that they've worked out very well. I'm particularly cognizant of what's happening in Stafford County. And, of course, we have a very strong sheriff's department there that continues to work with the school system. And it's a great resource, but it would be expensive having them in a lot of other places.
And same when we talk about sheriff's departments, it was an issue, in, at least in the Spotsylvania sheriff's race this fall, about body cameras. Mm-hmm. And local departments have talked about how they'd like to be able to have every officer have that, but there's a cost involved.
Yeah, there is. And it's probably not the thing that the state can get involved in, but because not everybody wants them. But
yeah,
I think you're going to see more and more of them.
A pretty important anniversary coming up for the state, as far as the 400th anniversary of the founding, I guess, of the House of Burgesses in Jamestown.
Yeah.
I would guess that's going to be a big emphasis when it comes around in a couple of years.
I hope so. They're planning for it now. We have designated the Jamestown Yorktown Foundation in Jamestown to take the lead in trying to put together a program that would commemorate the 400th anniversary of the initial legislative meeting of the House of Burgesses. And we are the oldest continuing legislative body in the Western Hemisphere, and that's a lot to be proud of. A lot started in Virginia. The Pilgrims came to Massachusetts for religious freedom. I think that the settlers came to Jamestown more for economic freedom. They were indentured servants or people that couldn't find work in England, and they came here to this land of opportunity. And it was difficult. It was a very difficult time, but they persevered and they survived. And it all started in Virginia.
Yeah, no, everyone should go down and walk around in the state capitol.
Yeah.
It's a terrific place to walk around, especially since it's having been redone a few years ago. No, but just to see the list of people who've been speakers of the House.
Yeah.
To have your name on that list at time, it must be humbling.
It is. Everything's very humbling about that. There's no question about that. I keep thinking someday they're going to scratch it out, but there's just so much history in Virginia, and it's good that we recognize it.
Now, the fact about being the oldest continuing legislative body is a great piece of trivia,
yeah.
but. Also, something to be proud of, and also, you know, there's to continue that on. It does show that there's an obligation to continue that on.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that it isn't just the legislative body where people were elected by their constituents to serve, but it's also really where the free market idea was born, was in Virginia, and the rule of law was really introduced into this country in Virginia. And it's important that we not only remember that heritage, but we continue to live by it.
I guess one of the things that changed over the years that you've been in the General Assembly, just we talked about years ago, you never had the option. If you wanted to see the General Assembly in session, you had to get in your car and drive down to Richmond. Mm-hmm. You can watch the floor sessions on the internet now, and there's just so many different ways to contact legislators.
Yes.
if you've got an interest in a particular bill.
Yeah, there's no question about that. The internet has really opened up the opportunity for constituents to let their feelings know. And all of us have websites, all of us have Facebook positions, it's easy to get a hold of us.
I know in the past you've talked to us about how as speaker you travel around and meet with other speakers mm-hmm. in other states.
Mm-hmm.
You still do that and come up with ideas.
It's very helpful. I was just talking with somebody about that yesterday. There's an annual speakers meeting which is held. It was held in Richmond last year, not 2 years ago, in 2014. And we'll have 35 or so sitting speakers come, and I've gotten to know some of them pretty well. And if I have a question or issue, or they have a question or issue, we don't hesitate to pick up the phone and say, "How'd you handle this in Wisconsin?" Or "How'd you handle this in Kentucky?" It's really helpful.
I guess, and to get together with people like that, they all legislatures near every state are different. I mean, some are full time. Virginia, a part time, and I guess you do get a feeling for the benefits of both ways of doing it.
Right, and I think we have the best system there, but I'm biased. And also as you recognize, Ted, this is a bipartisan organization. You have Democrat speakers and Republican speakers, and you have a guy from Nebraska who's neither. They don't go by party. Remember there. That's the only legislative body that's just – it's unicameral. They just have they call it a Senate.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they don't have a House and a Senate. They just have a Senate. And but they have a Speaker of the Senate, and he's nonpartisan.
I didn't realize that. That must go back to the days when it was – the territories out there were settled, I guess.
I know there's many times we've thought about trying to do it in Virginia, get rid of the Senate. But
It would make things easier for you, wouldn't it?
Don't tell Bryce I said that, or Richard. But
Now, Bryce yesterday brought up the point that one of the things he was a little concerned about, he just said that the time now that it's spent, that he spends with legislative things, he was concerned about the citizen legislature and just the, in some ways, that you either had to be retired or own your own business to be able to serve.
It does limit who can serve, and that's unfortunate, but it's a great system, the citizen legislature, as opposed to a full-time paid politician. I think that the beauty that it gives us, and I talk about this all the time, is that we have in the House 100 members, and they come from not 100 different situations, but they all bring their own life situations to the assembly. I've got pharmacists, I've got lawyers, I've got farmers, I've got manufacturers, I've got somebody that can be an expert in a question if I need to know about this. I've got three physicians, and it's helpful going talking to them about healthcare.
And I can be walking down the street in downtown Fredericksburg and see you in front of Gorick's or in, you know, any of you all around. So.
Yeah.
Well, the session starts Wednesday. Thanks for coming in. We'll catch up with you after the session. And good luck. Thanks for what you do for this area and for the state.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for what you do, Ted. I enjoy your program very much.
House Speaker Bill Howell of Stafford with us this morning. The General Assembly starts on Wednesday. We'll talk with Micah tomorrow on Town Talk. Thanks for listening. See you next time on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
I'm Bob Sizemore, retired pastor of Fairview Baptist Church, and I would like for you to think about God for a moment. This week,